Relentless Roger and the Caveman Doctor, Episode 16. Today, Dr. Champ and I ask, are organic foods any healthier than non-organic? How many carbs and how much salt should we be eating? And what exactly is hormesis? Relentless Roger and the Caveman Doctor, Episode 16. I am Relentless Roger here with Dr. Colin Champ, the Caveman Doctor. What's up, man?
It's been a while. It's great to be back.
I feel like it's been a year.
The hiatus was tough.
It was rough. And this show almost didn't get off the ground due to technical difficulties.
The hold button was on. On the podcast recorder.
We're swapping out batteries and throwing things against the wall.
Oh man, a lot has been going on in the last couple of weeks. It's been a while since we met, but I literally just got off a flight about 2 hours ago from Charlottesville, Virginia. Which, for those of you that are nearby, absolutely beautiful. Get out there. There's I think 150 wineries or something. The wine's delicious. It's beautiful, rolling hills, miles and miles of trails. Do yourself a favor and get there because it is great. Otherwise. Was interviewed on Underground Wellness. We did this kind of podcast roundtable. A couple of us were on there. Fat Burning Man was on there. Dean Dwyer was on there. And then Stephanie Rupp from Paleo for Women was on there. Sorry, Abel James. I shouldn't call him Fat Burning Man.
And He has a name.
Yeah, he has a name. Sorry, Abel. And Jimmy Moore was the one that was kind of handling everything. And Roger was away, so it would have been nice to have Roger on there too.
I was bummed that I was going to be away for that.
You were sorely missed.
I thought you guys did great. It was funny. It was a likable podcast.
Good. Thanks. And then I recently was interviewed on Fat Burning Man, Abel James, on the ketogenic diet and also on salt.
Yep.
And basically just low carbohydrate dieting, more of the science behind low carbohydrate diet. And that's one of the things we discussed on Underground Wellness, how there's kind of a lack of science per se. So I'll post both of those. Fat Burning Man, I think, should be out sometime this week. And then finally, Roger and I had a dude's night out a couple Saturdays ago.
Oh, and he's going to go there.
It was pretty, we ate liver, so it's kind of a silence of the lambs, like dude's night out, but liver and no fava beans, just onions. And then,
what else? Bacon, right?
Some bacon on there. We listened to some music. It was romantic. We listened to Nicki Minaj, or Kylie Minaj. No, just kidding. There's no music. And it was just hilarious. We went out and we had these Graham plans, how it's going to be this huge evening, and we get to this bar, and literally at like 10:30, we're both yawning. I'm like, I do this thing where I bite really hard on my jaw, so no one sees me yawning, but my nostrils flare out, and it was pretty obvious. So we didn't turn out as great as we planned, but the dinner was awesome.
You know, it's a really interesting point. I think when you get really into the business of your own health, and then you try and do a throwback night, at first, it's rocking. Right. Yeah. We had NorCal margaritas going, enjoying it. Your boy came over.
Yeah.
Right. All was well. And then you go out and then you're right. 10 o'clock hits, 10:30 hits, and you realize, maybe I'm not cut out for this anymore.
Not that cool anymore.
Right.
I mean, when I was planning, I'm like, there's going to be techno music and just craziness. And yeah, I'm in bed.
There was no techno music, no craziness.
No. We're old. It's pathetic. But so that's been.
We'll do it again. We'll reframe our expectations and we'll try to make midnight.
Yeah, once a month we're gonna.
That's right.
We actually talk shop most of the night. That's the funniest part. What's up with you, man? You have a lot of good news going on.
Yeah. So remember that whole Relentless Fitness up for best boutique fitness studio in Philadelphia?
How can we forget?
We nailed it.
That's amazing.
So it came out and we're right next to a picture of news anchor Cecily Tynan. Which is interesting. But yeah, we are the reader's pick for best fitness studio. So I think it feels really good. You know, this is our livelihood. This is what we toil over every day, you know, really six or maybe even 7 days a week, some weeks. It has been my life and Marissa's life as well for 2.5 years. So it is pretty sweet when you can rise up and topple some other giants in the field.
It's no small feat. There are a lot of fitness studios throughout Philadelphia. I mean, even the guy that won Biggest Loser has one here, doesn't he? Am I making that up?
Did he win Biggest Loser?
Or maybe he was in Biggest Loser.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Exaggerating. But yeah. So there's a bunch. That is no small
They were
small
in the like, same category.
Oh, that's right. That's
they
right.
They were up
right.
for the voting against
yeah,
us.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So awesome, man. Congrats.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. But hey, that's that's what's up here right now. We just got back from vacation, which was awesome. And I think one of the things I realized, I guess you go hard and you work hard for a certain stretch of time, and maybe you lose yourself in that a little bit. Like maybe you're just not taking enough time for yourself, to yourself, to de-stress, to decompress. And going away for that week to a lake in the mountains, it was just so nice. And maybe this happens to everybody when they go on vacation, but I really found myself saying, got to do this more.
Yeah,
got to do this more. But it was just beautiful being in nature, eating amazing food. On our way up, we had the biggest shopping bill of the year. I think we dropped between $400 and $500.
Wow.
But I mean, we didn't go out. It was one full week of breakfast, lunch, dinner, wine, you know what I mean? Anything we could possibly want. And we just stocked that place up and went to town.
It's awesome.
Yeah, man.
Jealous. Very jealous.
But it is good to be back. It is good to be back on this show. And here we go.
We have an action-packed, a lot of information in this one, so.
Get ready for some fastballs.
Sit tight, yeah.
All right. I'm going to lead this one off. We have a article titled, Organic Food No Healthier Than Non-Organic Study. All right. And this was actually sent to me by a client, which I really enjoy. He had been someone who took a look at my article on egg yolks, which was, of course, very critical of quote unquote studies being thrown out there and what they say. So he lobbed this one to me. Thank you, Sid. And what this says is organic food may not have, health benefits versus non-organic food. Mm-hmm. And that's the premise that they're resting this on. However, in the same article, they do say that there are likely, benefits when it comes to pesticides, right? To avoid pesticides. I'm reading it and I'm thinking, I don't know about you. I personally don't buy organic food because I think there's a different nutrient makeup.
Exactly.
I buy organic food because it's pesticide or as close to pesticide free as you can buy.
Mm.
That's why I buy organic food. So this quote, again, quote unquote article or study or whatever you want to call it, it's not news.
No. I mean, it's based on their definition of healthy.
Yep.
So I think the article shows that their definition of healthy is not our definition of healthy.
Right. So, I mean, it's funny how they throw that title out there, organic food, no healthier than non-organic study. They lead the article by saying nutrient content, vitamin content may not be different. And then they say, but there's probably a benefit when it comes to pesticides. Well, how does that line up with the title? I don't know. It's another one of those instances. I guess honestly, if we keep going down this road, our heads will blow up because these are going to come out every day. I'm just happy. I'm pleased. One of the reasons I wanted to bring this up, there was a direct link for me, a client who had talked with me about the egg yolk article, lobbed this one at me by his own volition. And I thought that was awesome. I was really happy to see, someone that I had had educated conversations with come back and say, check this out. This is terrible.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, it is.
No, it's great. The other thing too is the ethical issue here. A lot of times this is vegetables, but looking at organic, you know, meat, poultry, eggs, et cetera.
Sure.
It's generally not always, but generally kind of more ethical treatment of the animals or whatnot. So I think that plays in as well. And of course, they're not looking at that here.
Yep.
But it's another study that's no surprise, but how do you want to spin it?
You know, speaking of, this is a little tangent, but it boggled my mind the other day. I'll find it. We'll link it. But I forget where. I saw something on how, you know, GMO food, GMO crops are at some points infringing on non-GMO crops and can be affecting non-GMO crops to the point that some of them could, start to become genetically modified, right? They're enacting some sort of legislation. I don't know if it's going that far, but some sort of law where if those non-GMO farmers who are doing it, I think we would agree, closer to the right way, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
If those non-GMO farmers want to protect their crops, they have to take out insurance. So it doesn't matter that the GMO might be invading upon what they're doing and deteriorate the quality of their crops. they're the ones who are going to have to pick up the tab for it.
Yeah. Don't mess with the Monsanto.
Don't mess with Monsanto. Yeah. That is some serious stuff.
P.S. That was a listener. We are next to the hospital, and that was an emergency helicopter landing on the roof of the hospital. If you heard
we
that.
Changed locales. No, we're in the studio today, and we still can't avoid.
No police sirens, but that was a helicopter landing pretty much above us.
On our helipad.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah,
ready to whisk us away to Charlottesville. All right. So, anyway, that's a tangent, but GMO is not to be trifled with.
Yeah.
So, yeah, all right. That's number one. Moving right along to our next item, we have some bone broth to talk about. Our listener, Lynn, was nice enough to send this in. She sent an awesome long message. It looks like she's doing some amazing things with food. And two specific early takeaways for listeners caught my mind. She did say that if we are using marrow bones in bone broth, to make sure that you first roast those bones, take out the marrow, consume it, enjoy it, and then throw the emptied marrow bones into your bone broth. So I think that's a good call, because otherwise we're potentially tossing some good marrow later. Yeah. And then the second thing was, she said the best suited thing for bone broth or stock are split knuckles. And she said that'll create a really rich, full, gelatinous bone broth, which is, I guess, what you want. Once it's refrigerated, you want it to come out of the refrigerator and be almost like Jell-O or jelly.
All that collagen in there.
Yeah. So, thank you so much, Lynn, for those tips. So again, split knuckles for gelatinous broth. And if you are using marrow bones, split them open, roast them, split them open, enjoy the marrow, and then move on.
Good stuff.
Sweet.
So I have gotten many, many questions. And first and foremost, I apologize if I haven't responded. I'm literally about 50 questions behind. So, but nonetheless, many of these questions were regarding salt.
We're doing what we can, right?
Yeah,
we're doing
exactly.
Honestly, we do read everything. We reply to everything ourselves and with thought. So, in case we missed you, we're going to get to you. And, in case you asked a question and we said maybe we pop it on the show, we'll get to you.
Stop sending me personal medical questions. I'm not your doctor. anyway, LJ, great question. She says, do you have a working model of salt intake that you recommend based on height, weight, gender, et cetera? She's been paleo since February, has been up and down, manipulating her carbohydrates a lot, and never knew about this salt, as no one in the paleo sphere talks about it. But we talk about it here on the podcast.
That's right.
So she asked kind of, how do I know whether to go up or go down, et cetera? And especially, it sounds like she's working out pretty hard. So there's a couple issues here, and we'll get into kind of all these in a minute. But so first and foremost, how much salt do you take? There's really no great way to measure this. Himalayan salt or sea salt, because it is mineral dense and you want to get mineral dense salt. We are not talking about chemically manipulated table salt here. That is pure sodium and chemicals. So first and foremost, how much of that is enough? Regardless of my carbohydrate level, I'm very liberal with the salt amount that I put on my food. So I know I'm getting a bunch in. Generally, if I do very low carbohydrate dieting, especially if I'm ketogenic, I ramp that up to, you know, maybe an extra 2 grams per day, because I'm pretty liberal with my food. So I'm getting a bunch anyway. The way you know there's too much is if you're getting edema. So if you're getting swelling in your legs or you're just feeling bloated, I've never experienced that. And I've definitely a couple of days just for the hell of it have thrown a ridiculous amount of salt down just to see how I felt. So I'm doing a little bit no matter what. I kind of taper it, basically the reverse of my carbohydrates. So my carbohydrates get lower, my salt goes up, and vice versa. If I'm working out a lot, my salt absolutely goes up. This weekend I'll be playing volleyball. It's going to be about 90 degrees. I will salt load through the roof before and after that.
So I want to stop you there, because I want you to hopefully clarify something for me.
Sure.
And maybe someone has a similar question. So you said if your carbohydrates go up, you flip the salt intake, right? You would drop the salt.
I drop it. I still do a decent amount, but I drop it down.
I guess here's my question. Around workouts, salt intake goes up, right? But
absolutely.
So do carbohydrates.
So do carbohydrates.
So that's the exception to the rule.
Absolutely. And that's just because I know, especially if I'm going to do a workout where I'm going to sweat a lot. I mean, you could sweat, if you work out hard at an hour, you could sweat out actually the amount that ADA recommends to eat in an entire day. You can do that in an hour. So if you're going to be outside especially, I do a lot of salt loading then. The other issue, which Roger brings up all the time, which I'm glad he does, is, you know, a lot of these recommendations, especially for the salt loading, for salt loading where you're actually making broth, etc., is for hard workouts or for very low carbohydrate or ketogenic.
Sure.
Interestingly, I agree with that, but in terms of using liberal amounts of salt, once again, Himalayan sea salt or mineral-based, sea salt, etc., I think it's a place in everyone's diet. I think it's a vital source of minerals and sodium, which we need. And, I have an article coming out on this within the next week. Of all the studies we look at in terms of the issues with salt, the one question is, does it raise blood pressure? And all the studies show, the meta-analysis of some 53 studies, it lowers your blood pressure by 1% restricting salt. There's actually three really big studies that show that it increases your risk of dying by decreasing salt. And these are all these. This is all this crappy data, basically. So I don't know what to do with most of it. However, there is one study here which we will link, and it's called Reduction in Blood Pressure with a Low Sodium, High Potassium, High Magnesium Salt in Older Subjects with Mild to Moderate Hypertension. In this paper, they actually took people who had hypertension, high blood pressure, and put them on a mineral salt. So sodium, potassium, magnesium. And the key with this, first and foremost, their blood pressure actually dropped. And that's the issue. And once again, these studies are looking at modern foods. So if you're eating a whole foods diet, you're eating real salt sources, you know, from the ground, et cetera, not from a conveyor belt in a factory. I don't think it even matters. I don't think your blood pressure is going to go up. I think you're going to get good potassium in. And I think it's a healthy move for everyone. And then, you know, everyone be liberal with it. And then from there, you can go up or down based on how you feel. If you are low carb and you're feeling run down, you probably need more salt. I found that personally, and I found that professionally. And
it's a great point. It's a great point. I think salt quality does matter. And up until recently, I was using probably not the greatest quality salt. And I think you'll be happy to know, went over to Whole Foods and took the plunge on some pink Himalayan
Amazing.
Sea salt.
Nice. That's great to hear. And the other thing is that the white table salt. So it's sodium, and then it's about 5 to 8% of these chemicals that keep it from caking together. Mm-hmm. There's like ammonia and all these crazy things in there. So, I mean, once again, food quality matters. I've not seen a case where food quality doesn't matter.
Absolutely.
And it carries over to salt as well.
And as always, start where you are. And maybe that's a little too deep right now, but maybe you'll get there. You know, again, we talk all the time about this timeline of evolution for us, mm-hmm. and that 2 years ago, maybe we wouldn't consider something that we do today. Just stick with your timeline. You know, if you're all the way just dabbling into paleo, maybe what matters for you is just selecting decently, you mm-hmm. know, then maybe you move to grass-fed beef or wild-caught fish. Then, you know, you just take step and step Absolutely. And step. And then maybe when you have everything down pat and you're just looking to tune it up a little bit, you make that salt jump.
Yeah, and the other thing, Himalayan sea salt, is it's not that much more expensive.
Yeah.
Based on the amount of salt you eat in a year, which I eat a lot of salt, and it's still not that much.
Yeah.
You know, you're looking at most a $30 difference, maybe yep. 50 if you're eating tons of it over an entire year. So price-wise, it shouldn't be that much of an issue.
Yeah.
It's probably actually even less than that. And going forward from this, a related question from Al Jane, from tons of listeners out there, and thank you for the questions. So many questions on how many carbs to eat and when to introduce carbs. And a lot of people out there tell me how they've switched to low carbohydrate, very low carbohydrate, ketogenic, and they lost the weight. And kind of now what? Now what do we do? And I think for some people, staying ketogenic over the long term might be a better solution. There's some people that just can't reintroduce carbs back in. They are totally carbohydrate insensitive. But for the rest of us that are not, the question is what to do. And, you know, first and foremost, we are not condoning a ketogenic diet for everyone by any means. And if you look at my website and you kind of listen to what Roger says, numbers wise on my website, I always say to taper between 50 and 150 and just do a sliding scale. If you're losing too much weight, add more, go up to closer to 150. If you're gaining too much weight, drop it down. And the more you drop it down, then the more salt I add. It doesn't have to be that complicated. But then the real question is, when do we add those carbs in? And a lot of people would say it doesn't matter if they're good whole food sources, if they're, you know, sweet potatoes, green leafy vegetables, doesn't really matter. For the green leafy vegetables, I would agree. But personally, for adding in sweet potatoes, which is how I really get my carbs up, I've clearly seen a relationship of when I eat them.
Sure.
And I'm a big proponent of the before and after the workout, and this is an area of contention. But I'll quote an article here. It's a review article called Exercise and Insulin Sensitivity, a review. And they've shown that up to 2 hours after exercise, glucose uptake's elevated due to insulin-independent mechanisms. There's a thing called GLUT4 transporters on our cells. And a single bout of exercise can increase insulin sensitivity for about 16 hours afterwards. And this is why people often say, oh, it doesn't matter when you do it. But around 2 hours afterwards, you're very, very sensitive. So I always do carbohydrates beforehand. It does cause some increase in insulin, but insulin's an anabolic hormone. So the really one you want an anabolic hormone, obviously, is right before working out. Afterwards, you're most insulin sensitive. That's a great time to just really get your carbohydrates up, especially if you're trying to stay out of ketosis and trying to get those carbs in. I think that's the best time to do it. The best way to do it when you're insulin sensitive, you're not going to cause a huge glucose spike. And as a result, you're probably not going to add on that much fat.
You know, that's one of those areas that, like you said, maybe it's an area of contention. But for me, just from what I've been exposed to, mm-hmm. I'm not as concerned with studies. I feel like they'll naturally come around on this topic. I think this is one of those areas where you can look to some people in even bodybuilding, in the bodybuilding field, the people that are at the top of the food chain in terms of creating, you know, fantastically muscular, lean physiques. Mm-hmm. A lot of them have this consistent practice where they're putting the predominant portion of their carbohydrates after a workout. The second, you know, like you said, the second place would be before a workout. And I think that's fairly common practice there. So again, for me, that's one of those places where just through all of this anecdotal evidence that I take in, I see enough of that from enough smart people who have great physical results that I'm pretty sure there's something to it.
Yeah, I'm with you 100%. I mean, there's a reason. They didn't need data to start doing that in pumping iron, you know, 30, 40 years ago. It is really amazing, and Abel James and I talked about this too, it's really amazing how much you can learn from like your local meathead at the gym.
There's no doubt about it.
And there's years and years of anecdotal evidence to back it up.
And sometimes, you know, it's tough, right? Because sometimes it could be a non-starter. It's like, all right, well, I'll wait for the research to show it, or I'll wait for a study to show it. Sometimes, I mean, the clues are out there.
Yeah.
And sometimes all we have is that anecdotal, right?
It makes sense too. If you think about evolutionary, you run, you get a kill, and then you kind of have a feast right afterwards. Yeah. It's really right after your big time workout.
Yeah. You do something strenuous, you expend a lot of energy, and then you replenish.
Absolutely.
Right. Smack the forehead. It just makes sense.
Yeah. And it, for me personally, and most of my friends as well, they get better workouts in the gym. So yeah. For LJ, who she discussed her hit training and some of her other high intensity training.
You know, speaking of that, actually, I do want to say, although I agree conceptually that before the workout's probably the second best place to put carbohydrate, I don't necessarily always like to do it, especially if it's early in the day. A lot of times I like to go into a workout riding maybe a predominantly protein and fat, and then work out, and then definitely dip into carbohydrates afterwards.
Yeah,
sometimes I feel like I get a better workout. I mean, I guess maybe if you add a little carbohydrate, it's fine. But I find that if I add even a moderate amount beforehand, maybe my workout's a little more sluggish.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
No, I'm with you.
Just personal experience.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. I've been doing late in the day after work, so I have to get something in.
Well, that may be different. So I'm predominantly talking about something that's happening towards the tail end of the morning.
Yeah. No, I'm with you.
So.
Good stuff.
Well, we got one more. One more coming in from, cool if I go to this now?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Coming in from Lindsay, and Lindsay shouted out our mention of the DEXA scan the other week. And I think she just thought it was important to mention, hey, there's a risk versus benefit. And the risk to a DEXA scan is some radiation. Mm-hmm. And I think it's an important point. Even if it is a low dose radiation, it is important to put that out there. And so, yeah, I mean, the DEXA is giving you phenomenal information, and at the price of very low dose radiation. So I think it's an important thing. I'm actually interested. We had some conversation on it, and someone chimed in and said, maybe small doses of radiation is not bad for you. Does it promote, maybe it promotes hormesis. I'm not sold on that.
So this, that's hilarious. So this is, an interesting topic. So for the listener out there, hormesis is basically a small amount of stress, and it basically causes your body to counter that stress and recuperate bigger, faster, stronger, et cetera. So it is a healthy way. Exercise is hormesis, basically. You're pounding your muscles, they grow back stronger, et cetera. Radiation as hormesis has been theorized. It's a contentious area. I mean, listener out there, I'm a radiation oncologist. I'm around this stuff all day. And I agree with Lindsay. I'm not, small amounts of radiation freaks me out.
Yeah.
And I don't go through the scanners. I make TSA fill me up every time I go through, which is sweet. I get a pre-massage.
Is this podcast contaminating me?
Yeah, probably. Your monitor right now is actually contaminating you. So yeah, so there is some theory that a low dose of radiation could actually stimulate the immune system. Frankly, we're all getting radiated all the time. There's cosmic radiation coming down. There are the rocks in the ground are radioactive. If you go in your basement, it's sealed too tight. You're going to get radon. The stuff they make eyeglasses out of are radioactive. Bananas, potassium. A banana truck going through the New York tunnel can set off a radiation alarm. So we are constantly bombarded with radiation, which is likely why those DEXA scans don't matter. But our government model, which is interesting because they radioed us at the airport, is a linear no threshold model, which basically means any small amount of dose can in theory cause a cancer. So there is clearly a risk benefit. The other issue was with some of these patients that are getting DEXA scans, the benefit of them seeing their progress, that's the question. So if we actually need that for insurance companies to fund it, et cetera, the benefit of them losing their weight and getting more metabolically active here probably does outweigh any of those issues. But it's a good point to bring up. I don't know about hormesis. I wouldn't purposely radiate myself.
Right.
I'm around linear accelerators all day, so I'm already freaked out about it. But
so I guess conclusion there is maybe don't use that as a reason to get DEXA'd up every other week.
Yeah.
But if you do get DEXA'd up as part of a well thought out, well put together, you know, exercise and nutrition regimen to make progress, maybe don't be as worried.
Yeah.
Right.
I
so
agree.
Don't use it as an excuse to go over and over and over again. But if you are going as part of something bigger, then just don't stress about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think a DEXA scan, this is off the top of my head, so I could be wrong. I think it's about the amount of radiation you get when you fly.
Okay.
So, because you get a bunch of radiation.
That's true.
From that. So, everyone, if you live in Colorado, you're getting more radiation than everyone else.
So, what we're going to inspire is just burying our heads in the sand. And
you got to draw a line. I'm hoping because I get a lot of radiation in my job.
Yeah.
So, it scares me.
Can only worry about so much.
Yeah, exactly. Tangible takeaways.
Let's
do it. First off, exercise. You want to hit it?
Sure. Swimming is hard. Swimming is very difficult. So on vacation, we had a floating dock a little bit further out from a stable dock. And it was a great swimming distance to just kind of freestyle out there and back for time. And what I found was with swimming, I was, you know, certified back in the day, whatever the heck that means. I'm sure whatever it is long since lapsed. My breathing was off. I couldn't get it down, man. But every day I went back out there and by the end of the vacation, I thought, you know, swimming really can be a very, very solid workout.
Yeah.
I think I gained a little bit of a fresh respect for the water and what could be done in there. So just
it's
wanted to throw that out there. Exactly.
It was in a lake?
It was in a lake.
So that freaks me out when you can't see what's around your feet.
Oh man. You would have been freaked out then. You would have been freaked out. You could see by the stable dock.
Mm-hmm.
And there were fish. You could see the fish. But then once you got out and the water got a little deeper, you could no longer see what was going on.
If a fish hits my foot, I freak out. It's weird.
You could see pretty big fish jumping out of the water at certain points in time.
It's nice.
But I swam every day and I did not get hit by a fish. They steer clear.
Must be nice.
They probably were laughing as I floundered to the floating dock. But hey, if you haven't done it in a while, maybe you too could benefit from some freestyle sprints. If you remember, we talked a little bit about sprints some episodes back, suggested a park workout. That was when Colin was paged and had to leave the room. But I talked about running, basically sprinting a block, walking a block, sprinting a block, walking a block. Same thing in a pool, you know? Sprint and then casually. Maybe, and if you don't have the breathing down like me, maybe it's even freestyle sprinting and then literally walking back to the other side of the pool to catch your breath and then rotating that over.
Good stuff.
How about you, man?
Mine is kettlebells. Everyone's wants to get a quick workout, and we always talk about these sprinting, et cetera, high intensity. Kettlebells are quick, they're easy, and they're awesome. It's such a good workout, and I think people forget about them a lot because it's kind of the oldie but goodie. And just make sure you're doing it right. I'm going to post a video from here, Relentless Fitness, showing you how to do it right. Just make sure you're really hitting your glutes and not your lower back. I've always been heavy on my lower back, and my brother has really, really helped fix my form there. My brother and his wife, she has the best form of every exercise out there. So, kettlebells, get out there and do it. I do sets about 10, 8 sets of 10 reps.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's quick and easy, and you can have a kettlebell next to your bed.
Yep.
You know, wake up and get a quick workout, and it does not take very long.
No, absolutely not. My favorite form cue when I'm teaching the kettlebell swing is when the bell is traveling downward and when it hits its lowest point and you want to change direction, the first thing you do is squeeze your glutes as hard as you can. Absolutely as hard as you can. And you drive the motion from there. But I thought that helped me when I was learning the motion and as I've been teaching the motion, giving that cue. When the kettlebell reaches its lowest point and you want to change direction with it, the first thing you do is tighten your glutes as hard as you possibly can.
Nice. Good stuff. As for diet, I'll lead us off here. I'm going to quote another study. And this is just such an awesome study. It's from 1988. And it's Dr. Finney, who wrote The Art and Science of Low-Carbohydrate Living with Dr. Jeff Volek. Just an awesome study. It's called The Effects of Aerobic Exercise on Energy Expenditure and Nitrogen Balance During Very Low-Calorie Dieting. And what he did in this study, and this is very, very interesting, he took 12 people and he put them on a very low-caloric diet, so 720 calories per day. So extremely low, 1.5 grams of protein and 0.5 gram of carbohydrates per kilogram of ideal body weight daily. So we're talking like 20 grams of carbohydrates a day, 20 to,
so right in
to
that
40. Yeah.
Ketogenic range for sure.
Exactly. And so this was given to 12 overweight inpatients for 4 to 5 weeks. So these were inpatients. They were in the metabolic ward. He watched everything they did. Kind of the gold standard of these types of studies. 6 of them remained sedentary for the entire time. So for 5 weeks, they didn't exercise. They just kind of hung out in this metabolic ward. So I hope they paid them.
Sweet life.
Yeah. I hope they watched a lot of movies. I don't know. And then the other 6, actually, he worked them out, and he worked them out pretty good. For 27 hours over the 4-week period at 50% of maximum oxygen uptake. And so interestingly, in all these patients, lean tissue was actually preserved fairly well. And I think a lot of this was because it was a low carbohydrate, higher, protein, fat diet, et cetera. And the weight loss over 4 weeks in the two groups did not differ. It was extremely low calorie diet. And they lost about 6.5 kilos. That's 2.2 pounds per kilo. So they lost about 14 pounds. Interestingly, both groups in the first week, the resting oxygen consumption declines. So that's basically your resting metabolic rate.
Okay.
So that we know that if you eat less calories, your resting metabolic rate drops. You just have less energy. Taubes talks about this all the time. This is why little kids, when they're eating a ton of food, you know, is the food driving their energy? Is the energy driving the food, et cetera?
Well, and ends up being a preservation tactic for the body.
Exactly.
Because it thinks something's wrong and tries to hold on to what it's got.
Exactly. And
as always, any client who's listening to this who has been guilty of under-eating when trying to do more, when trying to lose more faster, this is one of those studies I like to point you to.
Absolutely. This is why it's hard. Well, even more interesting, so the group that did nothing, that stayed the same. That 10% got stable for the rest of the 4 weeks after that. But the group that exercised, actually, they continued. They had a 17% more reduction in the resting metabolic rate. So the calories lowered it, and then increasing their energy out, you know, so the whole energy in, energy out. They decreased energy in, they increased energy out. What happened? Their body slowed down when they weren't in the gym. Yep. This is why it's so damn hard to exercise off fat and why you can't do it. And you just feel like crap. Interestingly, too, their thyroid function dropped. T3 dropped as well. And they're saying, suggesting a relationship between this T3 and energy expenditure during severe caloric restriction. And this is just, you know, this is homeostasis. You can't change the in versus out equation. Your body compensates. And this is why it's so hard to eat less and exercise more. And this is an awesome study. I'll post it. And it's just, and this is a metabolic wart study, so hard to argue with.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. It's driving home some lessons that I find myself talking about on a, if not daily, certainly weekly basis with people.
Yeah.
It's not as easy as jumping on an elliptical for hours and hours and eating less. It's just not that easy. You know, that might get you some initial progress and you might be super stoked about that methodology and believe it's going to be the golden ticket. And then, you know, until it's not, until things start to shut down on you.
And don't stop exercise. There's a lot of good reasons to exercise. There's the hormesis benefit. Now there's a lot of health benefits for sure.
Yeah.
And the physical benefits, you look better, you feel better. But don't do it primarily to lose weight because it's not going to work very well for you.
Yep. Makes sense.
What do you got for us?
I'm just going to give a super easy, simple breakfast that's really been working for me lately. I think it's a nice takeaway. So what I started to do is I pick up some, center cut bacon, some, you know, nitrate free and all that good stuff. Basically the best bacon I can find at Whole Foods is what I usually pick up, and I'll cook up 3 strips of it. And in all the leftover bacon fat, I'll drop in 1/2 pound of collard greens. So dense leafy greens. I'll cook that up in there, get them out of there, and then I'll throw in 3 pastured eggs. And that's been my breakfast for a little bit now. It's been my go-to.
Sounds great.
For most days. It's been insanely satisfying. It's been really good. I'm happy I hadn't been putting vegetables into my breakfast for a little while, and I've been making the commitment to get up a little earlier so I can sit down, I can enjoy it. A lot of times I like to eat my breakfast before I have a cup of coffee. I find it helps me with the coffee a little bit more. So, again, just 3 strips of bacon, dump 1/2 pound of collard greens into the bacon fat, cook that up, dump in 3 pastured eggs, and call it a day.
Nice. I like it. I've had to get up really early and go to the OR several days. I'm not going to lie. I've been cracking eggs. I dump the whites down the sink and just straight
raw yolk.
Shock on the raw yolks. And they're actually pretty delicious. They're salty. It's quick and easy.
So, do you use a particular egg for that?
I use the pastured organic eggs from Whole Foods, or I have a local farmer that same thing. They're pastured.
Is that the Vital Farm?
Vital Farms. Yeah.
That's what I'm using.
Nice. Give it a go. So.
So how many do you do? How many raw eggs do you?
I do 5 raw eggs, and then I try to do a plate of kale or something else. Generally cooked in bacon fat, just delicious.
Great.
So that's
we're on the same page, man.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good to hear. I've been trying to get the calories up a lot, so
yeah.
Caveman corner, ready to rock.
It's that time. Caveman corner.
So my big thing is homeostasis. I was recently in Pittsburgh for my little sister's wedding, which was just a totally awesome time. And as is the case, every time I go home and my brother and his wife come in from Chicago, we work out together and kind of discuss things. And we really were hitting home on homeostasis here in this whole Dr. Finney article. My brother made a good point where he and I have definitely tried these experiments where you just increase your calories by, you know, 1,500 a day, and you do that for a month, or you cut them down, et cetera. And you really don't see that crazy of changes, and that it's just your body really wants to stay the same. And this is why it slows down when you exercise one area, it slows down in another area. When you cut your calories, it's really a fine interplay, and it's really hard to manipulate. And it further hits home the point that the calorie is not necessarily a calorie, because there's just a lot of things going on here. So keep that in mind. And if your progress is getting harder, and if you're losing weight, and the more weight you lose, it's harder, that's why. So I know that doesn't make it easier, but just keep that in mind and know that you're going to have to be a little more calculated about it. And this eat less and exercise more is not going to work. We're not programmed to let it work. And the Hadza study that came out, it showed during the day when they walk around so much, they burn so much energy that when they're not doing that, their body slows way down.
Sure, sure.
And it's the point where they actually don't burn any more energy than we do. So the whole, we're fat because we're sedentary is probably not the case. We're fat for other reasons, and now our bodies want to stay fat. So it's a tough battle. So hang in there and just keep that in mind.
All the crazy foods of the modern era, right? Throwing homeostasis out of whack.
Absolutely. So just keep
away from those foods.
Away from those foods and keep radiating yourself for that hormetic benefit. What do you got?
I have an interesting article. So I was on Mark's Daily Apple, and he wrote an article about, I think it had something to do with productivity. And it wasn't a feature piece, but it was a mini link that took me out somewhere else. And I think I followed the trail, like three links to get to this article. And it's a Lifehacker article, and it's called this, How Seinfeld's Productivity Secret Fixed My Procrastination Problem. This is about Jerry Seinfeld's comedian technique, where what he would do is he would take these blown up calendar pages and slap it on his wall, and he'd label it. So for him, obviously, he wanted to become a better comedian. And for him, he thought that becoming a better comedian was about developing amazing material. And how else could you develop amazing material other than to sit down and actually think it through? And so what he would do is he would set what he wanted to accomplish in a day. And if he hit it, he would take a big fat red marker onto his wall calendar and X that day. And if he did it the next day, he would X that day. And his idea was if he took these solid steps every day, then in the long run, he'd be an insanely good comedian. So it became a game for him of connecting the red X's, right? How long could he make that red X chain before he had to miss a day for whatever reason? And in his case, I think this worked out pretty well. But I love this technique and the thought process that the technique represents. First of all, I think no matter what, hey, if you want to take this and run with some work goal, I think that's amazing. If you also want to take it in into an exercise discussion, if you want to take it into some sort of a paleo, maybe a paleo challenge, an intro to paleo, trying to eat better, and set yourself some rules and throw up a big calendar and try to connect the red X's, I think that's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the cool thing for me is what it represents. And it represents that consistency is so, so important. What you do consistently is going to rear its head in the long run. And I've seen it here, you know, even we were talking at the beginning of this episode how this place, Relentless Fitness, has been open for over 2.5 years now. And I've worked with clients for almost 5 years now. So I'm starting to really see that long-term macro and have that macro perspective on someone's journey. And the people I see succeeding are the ones that have made those positive habits a part of their lives. And that even if they're not throwing a calendar up on their wall, they're people who could connect those red X's.
Yeah.
So again, this is maybe not specifically exercise or nutrition, but I think it does have applicability here.
Absolutely. It's everything. It's just going back to the homeostasis. You can't do anything in a week. You know, what do they say? A habit takes 28 days to get ingrained. This goes with working out, dieting, everything.
Dude, I will tell you this, that's the hardest thing to convince someone of. I go through it every single time. Right now, I'm kicking off the next round of transformations. And sitting at a desk with someone that you meet for the first time and trying to convey in, let's say, a 45-minute block of time, all that you need to convey about exercise and nutrition. A lot of times, people are coming in with, you know, the Biggest Loser firmly implanted in their mind. And the fact that they just need to look at a treadmill calories burned screen to tell them how well they're doing. Trying to change that mentality in a short period of time is very, very difficult. And again, I would just encourage people. I get it. I know that if you eat like that study, like the Finney study, if you eat 720 calories a day and you exercise for 6 hours a week or whatever, 7 hours a week, you are going to lose a lot of weight very fast. You are. You just are. And then all of a sudden you are going to break.
Yeah.
Hard to tell someone up front because all they see is that first week, the scale shifting down 7 pounds. And they're probably feeling okay at that point. then that second week, then that third week, then that fourth week. Somewhere along the line, that process will reverse and this will break and they'll be right back where they started, maybe even worse when they go binging.
Absolutely.
I mean, again, that's my daily struggle, is how to appropriately convey that to someone and have them trust me from day one through these processes. So
it's tough, man. Good stuff, though.
It's a worthwhile endeavor, though. It's very, very fulfilling when you come out the back end and someone says, you know, I never would have approached anything like this before. I never would have trusted that sort of a process, but now I do. I think it's one of the most fulfilling moments you could possibly ask for.
Absolutely. Good stuff.
Is that it?
Yeah. Sorry for the hiatus there, yeah. Everyone, but I hope this was an enjoyable experience for you.
Yeah, we missed you guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
It just wasn't the same. Even on vacation, I thought, something's missing this week. Yeah. No, but now we're back. And you know we've made it, man. We got our first non-5-star review.
Yeah, that was a sore spot for me, yeah. But you got to expect it, I guess.
It's amazing. You all of a sudden, you put yourself out there, right, on a podcast, and you put your daily work out there, and you put your daily thoughts out there. And like you were saying to me earlier, it's on record, you know? And sometimes I guess we're going to develop thick skin over time.
Yeah,
you know, it's wonderful to get some positive comments in. It really does make the day, but it is funny how it takes 10 of those to outweigh that one thing that comes in. But hey, you can't please everybody.
It's all good.
And you can't try or else you kill yourself.
Absolutely.
So hey, on that note, if any of you like what we're doing, hop on iTunes and shoot us a review. Let us know what's going on. Let us know what you think, and keep bombarding us with questions. Because even though we can't get to them all right now, we will get to them eventually.
Everyone have a good week.
Yeah, man. All right, Caveman Doctor.
Good stuff.
Episode 16. Roger. We're out.